Hey, Prime members, you can listen to this podcast early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the first episode of The Fall of Rome. I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me today. Let's begin with a quotation from the Roman historian Ammianus Marcellinus. Under the leadership of Olavivus, the Goths took possession of the banks of the Danube, and sending envoys to the Emperor Valens with humble entreaty begged to be received, promising that they would not only lead a peaceful life, but would also furnish auxiliary troops if circumstances required. While this was happening in foreign parts, terrifying rumors spread abroad that the peoples of the north were stirring up new and uncommonly great commotions, that throughout the entire region, which extends from the Marcomanni and the Quadi to the Pontus, a savage horde of unknown peoples, driven from their abodes by sudden violence, were roving about the river Hister in scattered bands with their families. In the beginning, this news was viewed with contempt by our people, because wars in those districts were not ordinarily heard of by those living at a distance until they were ended, or at least quieted for a time. But when the belief in what had taken place gained strength, and was confirmed by the coming of the foreign envoys, who begged with prayers and protestations that an exiled race might be received on our side of the river, the affair caused more joy than fear, and experienced flatterers immoderately praised the good fortune of the prince, which unexpectedly brought him so many young recruits from the ends of the earth, that by the union of his own and foreign forces he would have an invincible army. Also that instead of the levy of soldiers which was contributed annually by each province, there would accrue to the treasuries a vast amount of gold. In this expectation, various officials were sent with vehicles to transport the savage horde, and diligent care was taken that no future destroyer of the Roman state should be left behind, even if he were smitten by a fatal disease. Accordingly, having by the emperor's permission obtained the privilege of crossing the Danube and settling in parts of Thrace, they were ferried over for some nights and days, embarked by companies in boats, on rafts, and in hollowed tree trunks. And because the river is by far the most dangerous of all, and was then swollen by frequent rain, some who, because of the great crowd, struggled against the force of the waves and tried to swim were drowned. And they were a good many. With such stormy eagerness, on the part of the insistent men, was the ruin of the Roman world brought in. I'm Patrick Wyman, and this is The Fall of Rome. With these events in the year 376 AD, Ammianus Marcellinus claims, Rome's end began. The Goths, a barbarian tribe from outside the empire, had crossed the Danube into Roman territory. In effect, Ammianus tells us, the foxes had entered the henhouse. Exactly 100 years later, the last Roman emperor in the West, Romulus Augustulus, abdicated the throne. That name, Romulus Augustulus, was a grotesque parody of Roman history. According to legend, Romulus had founded the city of Rome more than 1,000 years before, while Augustulus was the diminutive form of Augustus, the imperial name of the founder of the empire proper. The empire ended with a weakling boy who happened, ironically enough, to carry the names of its dual founders. It was a fitting end for the hollowed-out, finished husk of a once-great empire, once the envy of the world. That right there is the basic story, the fundamental narrative of the fall of the Roman Empire. If you've ever studied this topic in high school or college, this is the version you probably learned. Hordes of savage, fur-wearing barbarians poured into a prosperous and civilized empire, defeated its armies, sacked its cities, and brought it to its knees, ushering in the Dark Ages and centuries of decline before the rise of modernity. But that's not the whole story. It's not even the right story. I'm Patrick Wyman, and I'll be your host on a journey as we figure out what the fall of the Roman Empire really was. I recently finished my PhD in this topic, and I wrote my dissertation about precisely this subject. If you want to get technical about it, I spent 7 years on one particular aspect of the fall of the Roman Empire, but this isn't the venue to dig into my poor life choices. What that means for our purposes is that what I'll be telling you here is the cutting edge of research on this topic, as much as a discipline like history can have a cutting edge. We're going to be talking about the latest that archaeology, genetics, Forensic analysis, climate science, and of course written texts can tell us about this period, the people who lived in it, and why it all matters. To do that, we're going to look at the fall of the Roman Empire in a few different ways. In today's episode, I'm going to explore what we mean when we say the fall of the Roman Empire. Where? When? What exactly made up the fall? What perspectives might we take on these events and processes, and why choose those guiding principles over others? The basic point I want to get across to you in today's episode is this. Rome wasn't built in a day, and it didn't fall in one either. The fall of the Roman Empire was a process, not an event. More specifically, it was an interlocking series of distinct processes that happened at different times, in different ways, in different places. The Roman Empire was a vast space that stretched from the deserts of Arabia to northern Britain, from the sands of the Sahara to the plains of Hungary. Some areas had already experienced massive transformations by the year 400. In others, life was little different in 500 than it had been in 350. How Rome fell, and why it fell, are complex questions that require nuanced answers. With all of this in mind, let's get started. We're going to start by defining our terms. What do we mean when we say fall of the Roman Empire? We'll need to be as specific as possible, both geographically and temporally. We'll begin with time. Now, you could make an argument that we should begin in the 3rd century AD, when the peace and prosperity of the Roman Empire, the Pax Romana, was shattered by a whole series of disasters, ranging from the economic to the political to foreign invasions. You could also make the argument that we should begin in the middle of the 5th century, when the various barbarian groups that had established themselves inside the Roman Empire became effectively autonomous. For our purposes, though, Ammianus Marcellinus's description of the arrival of the Goths provides the perfect starting point. That marked the first time when a mass migration, and that's what Ammianus Marcellinus describes, entered the borders of the Roman Empire without the express invitation of the authorities, and what happened afterwards shows just how quickly the Romans lost control of proceedings. Our starting point, then, will be 376 AD. But what about the end? Should we just roll with 476 and the abdication of Romulus Augustulus, like any high school history textbook worth its salt? That question is a bit more complicated and a bit more divisive. I'll say no, and here's why. In 476, very few people really thought the Roman Empire had fallen. Nobody even had any concept of what that would mean, and nobody conceived of things in those terms, really. The empire was all people had known for 500 years. It was the basic political framework through which they understood the world, and for another generation after 476, people continued to think in those terms. Barbarian kings were forced, like square pegs into round holes, into the well-worn roles emperors had occupied for centuries beforehand. Political discourse and ideas remained fundamentally the same. The economy, in most places, more or less kept working as it had before, and society changed only a bit. It's only in hindsight, and a couple of observers at the time, that 476 appears to be an important date. In some places, things had already changed dramatically by then, but in others, the changes that we associate with the fall of the Roman Empire had only begun to take hold. Settling on that date means that we miss some of the truly seismic shifts and focus overmuch on others. To focus too much on Romulus Augustulus, a weak and inconsequential figure by any reasonable metric, is to engage in something called teleology. We're picking an event and reading a great deal more meaning back into it than really anybody at the time did. It was only around 550 that the true magnitude of these changes had become clear, that all across what had once been the empire, things had fundamentally changed. The old categories and structures and ideas that people had used to understand their world didn't apply anymore. No amount of pretending could make them work, and Roman aristocrats, the kinds of people who have left us written records, were very, very good at pretending. When even they couldn't keep up these mental gymnastics anymore, that's how we know the transformation had truly taken hold. Nobody thought they were living through the fall of the Roman Empire, and really couldn't have conceived of such a thing even if they had realized the magnitude of the changes they were experiencing. So what happened around 550? Why pick that general time frame, plus or minus 20 years, as an ending point? Well, there are two specific reasons. First, that decade includes the ends of the Emperor Justinian's wars of reconquest. In 527, Justinian came to the throne of the Eastern Empire, more on that in a minute, and set about reconquering the western half of what had once been the Roman Empire, the part that had come to be ruled by a patchwork of barbarian kingdoms. The key word there is reconquered. You see, the people Justinian was going about bringing under his rule still thought of themselves as Romans, and the barbarian kings who ruled over them still generally maintained the fiction of allegiance to the emperor in Constantinople. But when an army from the eastern half of the Mediterranean showed up and said it would be liberating them from the rule of the barbarians, these western Romans finally had to come to terms with the fact that they were living in a different time, in a different world. The illusion that they'd clung to for the last 50 or 60 years, the idea that nothing much had really changed, could no longer really be sustained. How could they still be Romans, living in a Roman Empire, if there was now another empire coming to conquer them? That's one major factor. The other is something entirely separate from war and politics. I'm talking about disease, a pandemic to be more precise. This was the plague of Justinian, a preview of the Black Death that would devastate Europe in the 14th century. It was even the same disease, the bubonic plague, caused by the bacterium Yersinia pestis. It ravaged the entire Mediterranean basin and beyond and killed millions of people. By one estimate, this plague's initial outbreak killed 13% of the world's population, the vast majority of them concentrated in precisely the regions that had once been the empire's heartland. The combination of wars and plagues hollowed out the cities that had been the backbone of the Roman Empire. They reforged formerly prosperous areas into depopulated wastelands. The economic system, which had survived political upheaval and mass migrations, finally collapsed and transformed into something else in the aftermath of these twin specters of devastation. So that's our time period. We're going to be talking about the period from about 376 to about 550, give or take 20, 30 years on either side. From the Goths' crossing of the Danube to the reign of Justinian and all of the doom and apocalypse that came with it.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If roughly 376 to 550 is our time period, what about geography? When we talk about the fall of the Roman Empire, what places are we talking about? I mentioned the sheer vastness of the Roman Empire a little while ago, but let's go on a little tour of its borders as they existed in 376, when the Goths crossed the Danube. The empire's southernmost point was along the Nile River in Egypt, where the modern Aswan Dam is located, and it stretched down the coast of the Red Sea as well. The entire northern coast of Africa fell under the empire's sway, encompassing the coasts of Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, and even the Atlantic coast of Morocco, as far south as modern-day Casablanca. This region, especially Egypt and the territory around Rome's former North African rival Carthage, was the breadbasket of the entire empire. The grain that turned into the bread that fed the hundreds of thousands of city dwellers in Rome and Constantinople came from these places, and so too did most of the olive oil they used to flavor it and the wine with which they washed it down. From Africa we run north, The entirety of the Iberian Peninsula, today's Spain and Portugal, was a Roman possession. The best steel in the empire, and for a long time most of its silver, had come from Iberian mines. So too had some of its greatest emperors, men like Trajan and Hadrian, under whom the empire had reached its unquestioned peak. All of present-day France belonged to the empire, from the vineyards of Provence to the forests of the Ardennes and a minor city that would one day grow into the metropolis of Paris. The southern part of the island of Britain, a dreary and often forgotten outpost, was Roman as well. Hadrian's Wall ran from the River Tyne in the east to the Solway Firth along the Irish Sea, dividing Roman Britain from the lands of the Picts and the Scots to the north. Back on the continent, the border ran from the North Sea through the southwestern corner of the Netherlands. Nijmegen, the site of a massive battle involving American and British paratroopers in World War II, was just a few miles from Barbaricum, what the Romans called the land beyond the borders, the land of the barbarians. From there, the border ran into the very western piece of modern-day Germany. Neuss, Cologne, and Bonn were military border cities. You could stand on Cologne's city walls and stare into the vastness of non-Roman territory. The entirety of Switzerland was a Roman possession, and so was most of Austria. Vienna, Vindobona to the Romans, was another border city, and as was Budapest. Belgrade, the capital of today's Serbia, was yet another one of these militarized border cities. From Vienna to the Black Sea, the Danube marked the effective northern border of the empire. This was a militarized border. It had efficiently built forts staffed with professional troops every few miles, and in between, wooden watchtowers kept guard. Cities like Vienna and Cologne were military bases home to thousands of soldiers. Why? Well, because on the other side of that line lay the barbarians. We'll discuss them, and the border in general, in great depth as we move through this show. It's a really important topic. Now, all of Asia Minor, the modern-day heartland of Turkey, belonged to the empire. The mountainous eastern parts of Anatolia marked that border, with the plains at the northwestern edge of Mesopotamia, where the great Tigris and the Euphrates rivers rise, formed its easternmost border. A line ran nearly due south from there through modern Syria into Jordan, and finally into the very western tip of Saudi Arabia to the Red Sea. From there, we once again reach Egypt. On the other side of that long eastern border sat the Sassanid Empire, Rome's great foe in the geopolitical game of between the 3rd and the 7th centuries. For the most part, we're not going to be too worried about the Sassanids, or even most of the eastern part of the empire. That's because the eastern part of the empire didn't really fall, at least not in the way the Western Empire did. These terms, Eastern Empire and Western Empire, aren't meant to be approximations. Instead, they refer to distinct geographic and political units. Starting around the end of the 3rd century, the people in charge, and we'll talk more about them here shortly, realized that the empire had simply become too big for any one man to control on his own. The two halves were still tightly controlled through trade and politics, and the emperors were usually related or at least close, but they would each have their own ruler, their own bureaucracy, their own armies. There were too many crises for any one person to deal with, so dividing things up was the only way to ensure solid control over each. The western half of the empire included Britain, Gaul, meaning present-day France, Italy, the Iberian Peninsula, Africa as far east as today's Libya, and part of the Danube Basin. In the north, the border between the two ran through the western Balkan Mountains and today's Montenegro and Serbia. More than geography, though, what defined the two halves of the empire was language. The West spoke Latin, the East spoke Greek, at least for official things. It was the western half of this empire, the Latin-speaking portion that stretched from London to Belgrade, that fell. The eastern, Greek-speaking half kept going in some form or another for another millennium, and was only finished off for good in 1453 when the Ottoman Turks finally, after centuries of trying, conquered Constantinople. So we know the time, 376 to 550, give or take, and we know the places, the Danube Basin to Britain, and everything in between. But what do we mean when we say fall? This is where I part company from most of what you've probably read or heard about this topic. On the one hand, the fall of the Roman Empire was a political process. It's the story of how, in 376, there was an empire in Western Europe, and in 476 or 550, it had been replaced by a succession of kingdoms ruled by barbarians. That's the story you know. But that's just one small piece of the story, not the whole thing. In reality, the fall of Rome was a fundamental transformation of practically every aspect of life in Western Europe. One major piece of that transformation can be summed up as the barbarian migrations. Mass movements of people carried hundreds of thousands of individuals from outside the borders of the empire to places within it, transforming the demographics and culture of entire regions. Most of those groups came as armies, though they weren't the ravaging, disorganized hordes of popular imagination. Instead, these groups of wandering barbarians were often indistinguishable from Roman armies, and were usually led by men who had deep experience of the Roman military and its political structures. In fact, as a general note, the barbarian world, the world beyond the frontiers, isn't understandable as something separate from the Roman world. The two were deeply intertwined. Barbarians served in Roman armies, traded with Roman merchants, raided Roman villages, used Roman pottery, drank Roman wine, and dealt with Roman officials. Roman governors and military officers made cash payments to barbarian chieftains and kings as a matter of official policy, in effect trying to direct the course of political events beyond Rome's borders. As we'll discover later, by empowering particular kings over others, the Romans often created their own worst enemies. The barbarians didn't want to destroy Rome. They wanted a piece of that lifestyle for themselves because so many of them had seen it, and frankly, they'd seen how good it was. The Romans had wine, they had abundant food, material goods, wealth on an epic scale, even indoor plumbing. The leaders of these barbarian armies wanted land to distribute to their followers and power to wield, but they wanted Roman land and Roman power. No barbarian really wanted to burn Rome to the ground. You can't extract tax revenues from a ruined villa or a salted field, and there's no indoor plumbing in a burnt-out house. With that said, though, those barbarian groups did eventually create their own political structures in the areas where they settled. The Visigoths created a kingdom in southern France. The Franks took northern France. The Ostrogoths took Italy. The Vandals ended up in North Africa. The Burgundians ended up with modern-day Switzerland and a piece of eastern France. The Angles, Saxons, Jutes, Scots, Picts, and Britons divided up the island of Britain, and a whole succession of groups ended up in the Pannonian Basin and the Balkans. Whether or not the barbarians were trying to topple the empire, politically speaking, the groups that had migrated ended up forming the core of the kingdoms that eventually replaced it. We'll explore the question of responsibility in some depth later on.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
So the political shift from empire to barbarian kingdoms was one aspect of the fall, and the migrations were another, related facet that also brought with them tremendous social and cultural change. But one piece of the puzzle we're calling the fall of Rome that you're probably less familiar with is the fundamental transformation of the Roman economy. More specifically, that economy fell to pieces in the period we're talking about here. The Roman economy was based on the free and easy movement of people and goods through the political space of the empire. North African grain, wine, and olive oil supplied the needs of the city of Rome. Wheat from southern Gaul, today's France, fed the armies along the Rhine and Danube frontiers. Pottery from Italy and North Africa was the latest fashion in rural Iberia. Silks from China passed through the ports of the Greek-speaking East on ships bound for Rome, Naples, Marseille, and Seville. Steel forged in Iberia and Switzerland supplied the army in Britain and along the Danube. There's always a market for the most expensive kinds of things, and the movement of items to cater to the needs of the wealthiest will always exist. It existed during the Roman period, it existed during the downturn of the early Middle Ages, it even existed in prehistory, when amber from the Baltic and carved ivory were the peak fashion. Luxury goods have always moved and will always move, and Roman aristocrats did love their gold and jewels and purple-dyed silk. But note the kinds of commodities I talked about in my description of the Roman economy. Grain, wine, olive oil, pottery, steel. These were staples, the kinds of goods that have to move in vast quantities to be of any value to the people transporting them. If you're moving staples from place to place, you must have an exceptional infrastructure of ports and roads, and you must have an incredible number of ships, carts, and people who know how to use them to transport all those goods. Think about the complexity of this system. Think about the millions of people it employed in various ways. It allowed for the economic specialization of entire regions, the development of entire industries just for export. It's what allowed the enormous, wealthy, cosmopolitan cities of the Roman world to exist. The areas around Rome, Constantinople, Ravenna, to name just a few of them, couldn't feed the hundreds of thousands of people who lived there. The political system of the Roman Empire created the conditions that allowed this whole economic system to exist. When that political system fell apart, and a heavy dose of violence and war went along with it, the economic system couldn't survive either. For the average person in this period, the end of that economy was a far more important and meaningful event or process than who happened to be ruling over them at any given time. This led to thousands of deaths from starvation, and it caused a fundamental reorganization of society. What did it matter to a poor tenant farmer in, say, Tuscany, if you were ultimately being ruled by a Roman emperor or an Ostrogothic king? Both of them lived in Ravenna, and they were a world away from your day-to-day concerns. But in this sense, the fall of the Roman Empire produced a real change in material circumstances for that poor peasant farmer. Farming for subsistence in large part replaced economic specialization. Ports fell out of use. Consumer goods grew less complicated. The system that replaced the complex Roman economy was far simpler and far more locally oriented. Ease of movement and mobility defined the Roman Empire. That's what made it a single political, cultural, and economic space. There were local variations, to be sure, but everybody spoke the same language, everybody used the same currency, everybody read roughly the same collection of literature and philosophy, and everybody answered to the same emperor. The only way that could be the case was if people were constantly moving within the empire. By one locally sourced estimate, 40% of the population of the empire moved some significant distance at some point in their lives. You might have been able to tell the difference between someone raised around Carthage and someone who spent their formative years on the militarized Danube border by their accent, but those two people wouldn't have had any problem actually understanding each other. Constant movement of people is what made that linguistic homogeneity possible, in the same way that it supported a massive and an integrated economic system. So let me put my cards on the table. More than anything, what I'm arguing here is that the fall of the Roman Empire is about the replacement of those series of political, economic, and cultural systems that united Britain and Iberia, Gaul and Italy, North Africa and the Rhine frontier. While each of those regions had their own particularities under Roman rule, and we'll talk about how they differed, they still comprised one connected unit in a whole bunch of really important ways. What replaced this unified system was a bunch of regional kingdoms. In essence, the empire fractured. It split along regional lines. Gaul, as a region, had been made up of a number of provinces, each with its own governor and what have you, but each of those provinces was still subject to a larger whole. The kingdoms that replaced those provinces were not subject to any larger whole. Separate worlds grew up in place of that formerly unified system. Within 200 years, someone from Seville probably couldn't understand someone from Paris. A person from Rome couldn't speak to a native of Carthage without a translator. Political, social, cultural, and economic conditions in each of those regions evolved in their own independent ways, all at a much smaller scale than what had existed under the Roman Empire. This is actually a fairly controversial point, at least in comparison with a great many of my fellow historians. You see, there are two basic perspectives on this period, and they focus on either continuity or catastrophe. Right now, historians who focus on continuity kind of have the upper hand. They see the changes of the 4th, 5th, and 6th centuries as part of a long, ongoing transformation of the Roman world rather than a catastrophic break. You could still read the Roman poet Ovid in a monastery in Italy in the 7th century. A house built at the same time in southern Gaul might use Roman building techniques that wouldn't have been out of place 400 years earlier. A noble family in the countryside in Iberia might trace its ancestry to Roman senators in centuries past and might even use some of the same titles. Historians aren't wrong to draw out these continuities. Life didn't crumble overnight in the post-Roman West. That's what the historians who focus on catastrophe get wrong. One recent book made a polemical case for the scale of these changes. It was called The Fall of Rome and the End of Civilization. That's a bit much. Still, the historians who focus on continuity miss, or at least downplay, how much different things really were in many places by the year 600. Violence was a real thing that marked many people's lives in this period. Barbarian armies sacked cities, burned down villages, and committed mass murder and rape. The level of material sophistication declined and urban life disappeared altogether in many places. To deny or downplay that is as wrong-headed as overemphasizing it is. In this podcast, we're going to chart a middle ground between those two positions, and by keeping in mind the idea of regionalization that I mentioned before, we'll see how they're both wrong and right at once. A lot of the time, the difference between those two perspectives is simply a matter of where you choose to look. If we take Britain as an example, then yeah, catastrophe is a pretty persuasive guiding principle. But if we focus on southern Gaul, today's Provence, then continuity looks like a much more convincing idea. We'll keep both in mind and look at transformations alongside punctuated, catastrophic shifts as participants in and driving forces behind our big changes that we're seeing over time. But were the barbarians responsible for the demise of the Roman Empire in the West? And their hunger to take part in this prosperous system, to have a piece of Rome for themselves, did they accidentally bring the whole thing crashing down? Historians have debated that question for centuries now. Edward Gibbon, the 18th century historian who wrote The Magisterial Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, didn't blame the barbarians for the end. Instead, he blamed the degenerate culture of the late empire, its emphasis on vulgar wealth, conspicuous consumption, and what he saw as sexual impropriety. In Gibbon's mind, Rome fell apart of its own accord, and the barbarians simply took advantage of this cultural decay. The historian of the later Roman Empire, A.H.M. Jones, has another classic formulation of this view, though his point of emphasis is a little bit different. Quote, "The most depressing feature of the later empire is an apparent absence of public spirit. Under the Principate, Decurions had been inspired by pride in their cities and a laudable ambition to win the approbation of their fellow citizens. In the later empire, the government had to compel them to not shirk their duty." This was not an empire, from this point of view, that really deserved to keep going. It was rotten, it was falling apart from the inside out, and the barbarians merely provided the smallest of shoves that pushed it over the edge. The opposite perspective sees the later Roman Empire as an essentially healthy state. It had been through some rough times in the 3rd century AD, but the reforms of Diocletian, we'll talk a little bit more about them in a minute, had re-energized the system. The split into Western and Eastern empires provided some much-needed stability, while the army was on a solid footing, the economy was once again booming, and a nascent Christian faith was beginning to entwine itself with the culture and society of the Roman world. In this line of reasoning, the barbarians ended all of that. Quote, "Roman civilization didn't die a natural death. It was murdered," wrote the French historian André Pigagnol. The external shock of the barbarian invasions, not any inherent problem with the empire itself, is what toppled the Roman system. Again, we're going to chart a middle ground between the two. Here's my favorite formulation of that middle ground from the historian Guy Housel. Quote, The Roman Empire was not murdered, and nor did it die a natural death. It accidentally committed suicide. Now, in this perspective, Romans in 1,000 different places made tens of thousands of decisions, some of them involving the barbarians and others not, that in the aggregate dissolved the unity of the Roman world. What does that mean in concrete terms? What decisions, what actions in their thousands and millions led to the downfall of a political, cultural, social, and economic order that had lasted for half a millennium? These didn't have to be grand, life-altering kinds of choices. A landowner in Iberia might decide not to pay his taxes. Because the tax-collecting bureaucracy is going through some difficulty, nobody comes to collect. The next year, the landowner again decides not to pay his taxes, and this time his neighbor joins him. 5 years pass, and the tax collector finally gets his act together and comes to collect, but instead of finding one or two stubborn landowners who won't pay up, the whole district refuses to pay taxes, and suddenly the provincial and central governments are deprived of money that might have fed an army or repaired necessary infrastructure. Now let's think of a local aristocrat in Britain. Raiding Picts from what's now Scotland have burned some of his crops, and instead of appealing to a weak central authority for help, he decides to import a few dozen Saxon warriors from across the North Sea to protect his lands. They're good at their job, they work cheap, and they're plentiful. The next time the Picts come, his Saxons see them off, and the aristocrat realizes he can import a few hundred more Saxons, and with that private army, he can make himself the most important man in this little area. After all, the imperial army isn't doing much anyway. But soon, the Saxons figure out they don't need that aristocrat, and they decide to strike out on their own. And now you have a band of a few hundred freelancing warriors running around the British countryside, all because that aristocrat didn't think about the consequences of bringing them over. Or let's imagine a city official in southern Gaul in what's now Provence. He's lived most of his life in this region, but like his father and his grandfather before him, he received an education in Italy and spent some time working as a bureaucrat in the imperial court. But now he decides to keep his son at home to be educated, not to send him to Italy for schooling or to work at the court. That son never learns an ethic of service to a central imperial power. He feels no real connection to the idea of an emperor or empire. His grandson feels even less connection. Now, those are just three of many potential examples that we could choose. On their own, they didn't bring the Roman Empire down, but stack up enough of them in hundreds of different places, and you can see how things in the aggregate start to go awry. So now I've acquainted you with the broad outlines of the fall of Rome. Where, when, what processes make up the fall, and how we're going to be thinking about and talking about these topics. This is the base, the foundation, for what we'll be discussing as we move forward. Some episodes will provide narratives for each of these topics, focusing on the army, Roman politics, barbarians, the economy, or particularly important events like the rise of Attila and the Huns. But it can be easy to forget that millions of real people, people whose names and life stories have been lost to us, experienced these events and processes. To make up that gap, some episodes will include reconstructions of the lives of hypothetical people. Yeah, to some extent these are going to be fiction, but they'll be fiction with the purpose of grounding our abstract concepts in something concrete, based on our best understanding of these things as they happened. Next week's episode will be in that vein. We'll follow a barbarian, a Goth, one of the people Ammianus Marcellinus called the ruiners of the Roman Empire at the beginning of this episode, on his journey from the frontier to the very center of the Roman world. Thank you for joining me for today's episode. If you have a spare moment, I'd appreciate it if you left a rating and a review. You can follow me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at PatrickWymanMMA. And if you have questions, comments, or concerns, or if you just want to chat a bit about the fall of the Roman Empire, drop me a line anytime. If you want to help me out even more, I'd really appreciate it if you took the survey at wondery.com/survey. If you're looking for more history podcasts, check out History Matters on iTunes and SoundCloud. A historian friend of mine and I, Keith Plimers, are talking about present-day issues in historical perspective, tackling topics like political breakdown, settlement patterns, globalization, and much, much more. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, this has been The Fall of Rome.